So welcome, everyone, to the fourth precept. Refrain from saying that which is not true. I undertake the training. And as I was mentioning last week, and as I'd like to start off this week, to think of every aspect of the Buddha's teaching, but since we're on the precepts, we'll narrow it to that. But and that the precepts are roads into the perfection of Buddhahood. So it's not a call to change and modify our behavior as much as it is a call to see and understand in a different way. That's a very important difference. I was at the, some of you might have been there, I was at the Family Dharma Day this weekend on Saturday at the Seattle Buddhist Temple down in the International District, and a number of adults and children from different traditions had come together to just talk about how to make family life vital and important within the Buddhist tradition. And we had a discussion on how to raise children, which is ridiculous because I don't have any, but they invited me to speak. And never being at a loss for words, I went ahead and fulfilled the mission. But what I heard from those around the table were a shift depending upon their own background in Buddhism. And oftentimes, their background was not based in practice, in the actual focus of changing their own life in accordance with the truths of the Dharma, but rather to use it as a kind of script or blueprint for their life. And many of them there were trying to sort of talk their way or think their way into the logics of Buddhism so that they could understand from their actions how to do things, right speech, right action, right livelihood, etc. And it just dawned on me how precious it is and how rare it is for people to go in through the front door instead of the back door. The front door being the door of actually changing ourselves into Buddhahood rather than practicing Buddhism. And those of us who practice with earnestness, sincerity, I think have a real step up in understanding how the precepts in particular are not admonitions. They're not constraints, but invitations towards the profound understanding and insight from whence that precept arose. To say, I will not take things that are not offered, as I said last week, or that I will not say things which are not true, in one way sounds like a dictate from God, but seen in the opposite direction is an invitation to see that view. What is it like to live in a space in which I don't need or want to take anything, nor do I have the desire to protect myself by lying or exaggerating the truth. See, there's a different, and as I began to think about that, one is very much the analysis of the precept, the analyzing it, and the mind never puts an end to itself. One woman there, I remember saying, said she'd been a Buddhist her whole life, and had never stopped analyzing how to be a Buddhist. That's a very different perception than dropping into the heart and seeing what life is lived from the heart of affection, from the heart of connectedness. Speech from the heart center is not seen as a mental position, as something that I'm doing in order for me to fill in the blank. It's not seen as a contradiction or as an enemy or as an argument. In fact, when we base ourselves in the stillness and quiet of the truth, we see the contradiction in trying to apply any strategy to this landscape. And that why speech is the natural unfolding of speech through the understanding of connectedness, of the hearts being together with other hearts. And I say this as an encouraging way to bring us all in to that sight, to that vision. Because I have to keep reminding us. And growth isn't something that happens and then you put it on the shelf and relate to it. It's an active ingredient. It's something that is continuous. Practice is an ongoing experience. And so when we take this practice on, we never cash in our chips. Say, well, I've had enough practice, now I'll be wise. It's really the expression of the seat that we take and finding ways that, what is it that keeps us from this seat? What is it that, where do I lose my reference towards that? And so the insights that occur from the precepts is that the precepts indicate where we have lost our way, where we're no longer practicing, where we're no longer applying the strategy, but we've lost our mental reference. So speech is not something, I'm going to practice, this week I'm going to practice wise speech. And next week I'm going to do something else. But this week is devoted, it's sort of silly to think of it that way, do you see? So we are going to practice wise speech this week. But we're going to do it with that understanding that it's not a task in and of itself. It's not an end in itself. It's as I mentioned, a part of the holograph of the teaching. And every door, every aspect of the teaching, you enter the entire image, the wholeness of the teaching. Now, speech is, any speech that is against or creates division, obviously, is coming from a mindset of protectionism and opinionation. It comes from a positionality. And why speech doesn't come from positionality. It doesn't come from me in argument with you. Oh, yes, I'm in argument, and I remember now that I have to have wise speech. So even though I hold the inner argument, I say nice things to you. So that I follow the script of wise speech, but not the heart of wise speech. It doesn't work that way. It's as unwise speech to hold the heart of betrayal and opinionation and speak from that as to say wrong and harsh words. That the heart has to line up with, the speech has to line up with the heart and can't be in contradiction to that. And it's interesting because when you really take wise speech to the core of what it means that we don't form polarities. In fact, wise speech is holding, you might say, all opinions. And so this endless debate that we find occurring in and out of the Buddhist circles about what do we do when we're attacked by terrorists. First, let's hold the view that we all are in this together, that we're all connected in this thing together, and that there are degrees of ignorance within certain consciousness that need to be addressed and looked at. It's not that there is no action from wise view, but the action is in accordance with wise view. And so is our speech. To say, this is what the Buddha would have done, we don't know. We don't know anything until we ourselves integrate into that form and perspective of seeing. Then we can move from an integrated action through our speech. Now, it's interesting about speech. When I've talked about this topic several times. It's one of the Eightfold Path. And I actually did a series several years ago on four sessions on just wise speech. So there's a lot to say about it. But I think that's the most important point, is that it cannot be separated out from the rest of the Eightfold Path. And that it isn't a strategy in and of itself. It's not an end to speak well. That it connects with all aspects of the teaching. Unless all aspects of the teaching are upheld, then why speech is not upheld? And that's why we don't want to use gimmicks to learn how to speak well. We want to learn how to ultimately change our consciousness to hold and see connectedness. And then we will speak from the heart of that connection, and then wise speech will take care of itself. Now, we can use the gimmicks and the strategies to show us where it is that our view is off. But what happens often is that we trump ourselves with self-dislike and self-punishment when we get off the mark. Oh, there I did it again. I lied again. And as I have said many times, we'll tell this story again, knowing that all of you have heard it at least a dozen times, but it doesn't matter. When I was just getting into my working with this particular precept 25 years ago, I kept a little notebook in which I would mark down times when I was not appropriate in my speech, and then I would count the number of marks on Tuesday and compare it to my number of marks on Wednesday. And it just isn't very helpful to have that kind of numerical system against yourself. You cannot win. In fact, somebody came in and I said something a little skewed, marked it down, and then the person says, well, what did you just do? And I lied to them. So even in the midst of holding this particular strategy, I couldn't keep myself in alignment with it. Because the forces of wise speech are much stronger than our need to be good. You know, it really doesn't have anything to do with always speaking appropriately and never offending. You can see what effect political correct speech has. Its intention seems to be to bring us into alignment with certain ways that we're insensitive. I mean, that's its purpose, so that you don't say, you call people of color instead of African American or whatever. So the purpose is to bring people in alignment with a certain degree of sensitivity. But it turns out that everybody judges from that space and condemns from that space. And so you feel this tightness of container that you're afraid of saying anything wrong. Not he and she. If I ever said he was, oh, he and she both, you know, it's like you're just, the language is not free anymore. It's you have to, yes, the direction is in the right direction towards greater sensitivity to all genders, to all races, to all. But how we judge and weigh when we fall back into old patterns, is just I see we're boxing each other in that way. So speech. It's a speech is one of the few actions we take that is almost always done with someone else. I mean, that's, we're not talking about thought now, we're talking about speech. Although, if you look at some people walking along the sidewalks, and you wonder sometimes whether that's always accurate. But there's a kind of risk in speech, and I just like to talk about some of the vulnerabilities of speech, because speech does have a kind of risk to it. And we can fall in patterns based upon how we hold ourselves. In fact, speech has an enormous opportunity for self-discovery that we don't usually realize, but it's the manifestation of how we hold ourselves inwardly. And we don't use it for the learning as much as for to further the sense of self-condemnation. And so we first have to be aware of the vulnerability and risk that comes through speech when we're putting ourselves out there on the line of a verbal. We often are trying to weigh what to say given how we think the audience will receive it. And that's one of the mistakes we make in terms of that constant sense of self-adjustment we make to different people who we evaluate as needing something from us, and we shift to try to meet the ground that their expectation is on. And we constantly find ourselves inwardly unbalanced from that shift. And all the fear and social pain associated with speech. Enormous. And so, sometimes it's we're afraid to say, I mean, it's what we don't say. We see something and we don't say it, or we don't respond to it, because wise speech is also realizing what we don't say. Realizing and why we don't say that. Because we keep ourselves in check. Again, through the vulnerability and risk. But the whole thing needs to be focused on self-discovery. If we place the emphasis on self-discovering ourselves as we speak, then we're going to see very quickly when we're in a complaining and judgmental mode, when we're kind of irritable, and it comes over. And it may not be as quickly referenced in terms of the mood, but it's immediately obvious in terms of the verbalization. Not only to ourselves, but the people we're around. And I've said as many times, like energy tries to find itself, so you can begin to see not only how you speak, but who you hang around in order to encourage that energy, that irritation energy, where irritable people kind of come together, you know, and sort of wallow in the irritability of it all. Or that self-deprecating speech, where when somebody says to you something flattering or something complimentary, how we hold that, how we brush it off, the moment of, well, I'm not. This is right there. I love that moment of hesitation, that moment in which we aren't able to hold the compliment. In which something there is raw, something there we don't believe in, and we think that what they're seeing is just the smoke screen of a deeper. They aren't seeing the real problem. They're just seeing the manifestation of some momentary, but not the real me. How do we handle compliments? And you can learn anything to cover it. I mean, you can even learn to say, oh, thank you very much. And inside you still feel, he doesn't really know me, or he wouldn't say that. But because this is not an uncommon quality, we begin to see, okay, I can learn that one. And we cover over the real learning, which is to feel the pain of the rawness of and the inadequacy that we hold ourselves. You did a very nice job tonight, Rodney. Thank you very much. Right? We all have that. And how quickly the past can implode. I think this is, as we speak, we're often speaking not from spontaneity, although we think it's spontaneous, but really just from conditioned past, just kind of on our old, just old habit, just old patterns that we've fallen into again and again. There's no spontaneity there. It's just old habit patterns, but we feel very comfortable in those habit patterns. But, this is from the Course of Miracles. What we recognize in another, we strengthen in ourselves. What we recognize, when we recognize something in another, we strengthen that tendency in ourselves. And so too, when we speak, we are giving forth a kind of energy that allows other people to assimilate and gain access to that quality in themselves. Speech is amazing, really. When you watch how it works in the mind, thoughts come from who knows what. None of us know. I've watched it for almost 30 years, and I still can't tell you where a thought comes from. But it's the first indication of something being created in form. It's like, something becomes manifest. And then the next leg on the journey of embodiment is that thought manifesting in words into the first step of action. And so speech is really the right on the crest of the unmanifest and the manifest, with thought just giving rise and just coming out. And speech can't be recovered. It's interesting. You say something and you... I had one occasion when I was a high school student. I said something that was just abrasive and completely inappropriate, and it haunts me to this day. Sometimes when I'll be sitting, it'll come up in me. And with the impact of all the... I'm not going to tell you what I said. Because to this day I'm ashamed of it. But that's how, once it's out there, it's like the rock has hit the lake. Now you can't stop the ripples. The ripples just go. And as far as the lake is, that's as far as the ripples are covered. And to feel the impact of each stone on the lake in terms of the ripples, the tremendous influence that speech has in terms of communicating the energetic layer and intention and direction and judgment that we all contain. Is it any wonder that's why speech is so difficult, with the amount of self-dislike that we have? Because the self-dislike feeds the inappropriate speech. And if you combine that with 300 million people in a country, you have a lot of very volatile ripples on that lake, colliding into each other. And yet, there's a question of refraining from. See, that's true renunciation. In the moment we just refrain, not, again, damn, why does that keep arising in me? That's not refrain. Refrain is pause. Before I say this, let me just pause. In the pause, there's the opportunity for some clarity of connection to occur. rather than just to move out in terms of divisiveness, I give an opportunity, there's an opportunity for divisiveness to come together in terms of connectedness. And so I let the pause go. I mean, I let the impulse go and I just hold it. And that's the refrain. I'm refraining from the past impulse, the past wave, because those waves don't just go outward, they continue to circle inwardly. The waves, you might say that each time we drop speech into the pond, those waves continue to ripple in us. And they, in some future time, will have their rippling effect back out of our mouth again. And to refrain from that. Some coarse or harsh statement, some inappropriate way. Just refrain. This isn't connecting. So that's true renunciation. You see how that's... Okay. Just let that go. And the person of practice, the man or woman of practice, the person of practice needs to have a good sense of what it is that's driving the communication. What are our needs in this particular situation? What is our intention based upon those needs? How do those needs manifest in terms of speech? What are we really asking for? And is the way we're asking for it meeting the needs that we have? Oftentimes our needs are so enmeshed, so confusing, we don't have a sense of any clarity. We just feel kind of bottled up. And we don't even recognize the emotional element within those needs, the urgency we might feel or whatever it is, the impulse that's driving it. We just feel something. And we're off running, rattling our teeth to try to access what it is that we're needing. So to get a sense, okay, what's driving this? What's driving this question or this comment? And if we aren't sure, then maybe it's better to refrain. Maybe it's better just to be quiet with ourselves. Until we are sure. For the longest time, I would sit in meetings, and I'd always have something to say in the meetings. And it's really just in the last very short period of time that I just wait until the meeting moves in a certain way that I'll come out and say something. It's not necessary to lead with your trump card every single time. Well, I don't think that's right. And you look around and nobody has even questioned whether it was wrong or not. So you just, okay, you just let it go. So is the conversation mind-driven or heart-driven? The Buddha made it very clear. He said, speech should come from a kind heart. And the homework tonight, I hope everyone picks one up, because I think, you know, to use these five different forms of wise speech to guide our speech, we want to give feedback and we want to tell people and put them in their place and all of that. And this gives a guidance to how to offer people feedback and how to communicate with them effectively. It's not meant to tie us in knots. It's meant to bring forth encouragement and sensitivity in that area, to bring us into the heart so that the compassion element rather than just the wisdom element. The wisdom element says, you did something wrong. Because it's true, you did something wrong perhaps. But the compassion element finds a way to say that you have done something wrong, finds the right time to say it, finds the right conditions, finds the right moment so that you can communicate effectively with somebody what it is your concern might be. And that's what this homework attempts to do. So it's from one of the Buddha suttas. Now, we can't talk about wise speech without talking about how to listen. Because many of us listen as a waiting. We wait for there to be a gap so that we can speak. So we're not really listening, we're waiting to speak. And that waiting to speak keeps us from really listening to what the person might be saying. To be able to listen to what the person is saying and then respond to what the person is saying, instead of seven sentences back, there was a point you had to make, bringing ourselves current in the conversation. And that's an interesting exercise in and of itself. It's actually allowing the speech to unfold from the speech of the other person rather than from your abiding interests. So being able to receive what someone is saying and then being able to offer a perspective that is not divisive. Doesn't mean you don't have a preference. Doesn't mean you don't, you know. But it isn't, it's the way the self, the me, forms around the opinion, coalesces around that in terms of its emotional stake it takes in that particular point, and the sense of righteousness it feels in that view, the opinionation of it, as if there was only one opinion in life. But you're right. Well, look across the table there. There's somebody else who equally thinks they're right. But it doesn't matter because no single view, even if some God says, yes, you're right, it still is a limitation on the particular, is on the situation. Because any view is a limitation on the situation. So how do you hold a situation and speak from it? By receiving the situation, by listening to the situation, by having what in Buddhism is called clear comprehension of the situation, not by picking out a particular aspect of the situation and rebelling against it, but by being able to hold all the part and parcels of the situation. And that can only be done in silence, in stillness. And I think that's what our fear is. One of the reasons we speak so much is that the chatter keeps us from feeling the pain, our existential pain. I mean, there are many reasons we speak, to connect and to inform and all, many legitimate ways, but there are also many illegitimate ways that we speak. Often it's driven by loneliness. When we do offer retreats, often the retreatants, because they're done in silence, some of the retreatants who are new to this form of practice will come up and say, the hardest thing about it is not speaking and not making eye contact. And when you investigate that with the person, it's because they're not being affirmed. And much of our life, for many of us, is that need to get affirmation through someone else smiling at us or speaking to us or validating us verbally or non-verbally. And to cut ourselves off of that is one of the values of retreats, not the limitation, so that you can see how we're driven and dependent upon those conditions from another. Because those conditions are manipulated, or can very easily be manipulated. People know when that's happening, and you can then manipulate the situation so that we become our actions are driven by what the other person wants us to be. That's a very different understanding than just to leave somebody alone, which is really at the heart of Dharma. Just leave somebody alone. So, one of the illegitimate ways that we speak is in order to connect so that we can be affirmed. So we have to be aware of our need to be affirmed. And we're often driven by loneliness, so we have to be aware of the loneliness. So the mindfulness of speech, first, for most people, it starts in the body. Being grounded in the body. Because speech is so air, I mean, it's so much thought, that the bird takes flight as soon as the speech begins out of the mouth. Your mind's just off. So if we have some reference to being able to steady ourselves in the body, the first foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of the body, and then speak from the sense of bodiness, from the sense of body. And the first thing we have to be aware of is the fear of not saying something important or vital or worthwhile. And then the fear that we won't have something to say at all. Because if there's a silence and there's no talk, oh my God, there's a sense of awkwardness. I love that moment of awkwardness. So much of the self comes in there. It's such an opportunity to see the arising of who we are in that moment of awkwardness when you're not saying anything. There's nothing particular to say, and you don't know the person that well. And in it comes, what is he thinking of me? I don't have anything to say. I'm not rich enough of a person to even fill in this beautiful day. First dates. So mindfulness, recovering first the body, and then being aware in the body of what our neediness is in that situation, of wanting to be affirmed, or that we're lonely, or that we're feeling something, some pain in ourselves. And then we have to, there's a next step, and that's the fear we have of stillness, of quiet, of not filling the noise in. Not because we have some psychological need to fill it in, but because of the implications of stillness itself, the uncomfortableness of quiet. Now, many of us in this room don't have that because we sit quietly. But many people do. So it's oftentimes the speech may not come from the loneliness. It may come from the rebellion of the quietude, of the stillness. So to develop a comfort and an ease with being still, with being quiet. Then the embodiment, the mindful embodiment, also embodies the stillness. See, at each layer of resistance, the body, as it begins to acknowledge and be accountable to that resistance, begins to embody it. So then you have the feeling of loneliness. Okay, I can embody that. Then you have the stillness on the other end of loneliness. Just being quiet. And then you're in wise view. Because the only reason we were not in wise view was the reactivity of the different levels of pain, to the different levels of pain, to my neediness away from my loneliness, for my desperation, for my need to be affirmed. And if we just embody that through the body and feel it, it's right here, means nothing. So why is, you see? Then we begin to see how it is that the mind moves back from the past. The past needs come back in, and if we aren't right on top of it, embodying those needs, we're going to be off exaggerating. Exaggeration is a flight to fantasy. It's like following your desires. I'm this and that, and I'm so this and that, and you can just move out like Walter Mitty into the world of just whatever you want to be. Just exaggerate, lie. The difference between exaggeration and lying is just... And so then you see, just flight. It's just flight. You can be anything you want. You meet somebody new, hi, I'm a rocket scientist. Yeah. Well, so am I. Let's talk. So exaggeration and lying, or the need to self-protect, you know, I need to self-protect. I've got to hold myself in a certain way. I've got to protect. Why do we lie? Why do we exaggerate? Not condemning ourselves for it. That gets us nowhere. The whole method of wise speech. I had it written down somewhere. I thought it was so good, which I can't find. Anyway, it had something to do with the reason is not, you know, to be strict in our speech. It's an invitation to understand why that we say the things we do. Why speech is an invitation to examine our speech, not an adherence to a certain strict code of conduct of speech. Now feel your heart warm to one. If it's a strict code of conduct, then we're all miserably sinful. If it's an invitation towards self-examination, oh wow, look at this. Look what I'm doing here. Off exaggerating again. Why am I doing that? What's the motivation behind that? I want to know. Because it's keeping me from the holograph of freedom, from entering that sense of stillness. So I want to know this. Not in some self-condemning way, but as an invitation towards better understanding how it is that I operate, you see? That's the movement of each of these precepts, and in particular tonight in speech. We hold ourselves so to such the letter of the detail. And many of us have the tendency anyway to keep a lie notebook on ourselves. It doesn't work. Doesn't work. Too many checks. Too much failure in that notebook. But this constantly question, well, what's going on now in me? What's that about? What did I say that for? What was that about? Now, no talk on why speech is going to be complete for me without the component of self-abusive thoughts. Because inward speech, our thinking, is a subtler manifestation of our external verbalization. And we have to be aware of what it is and how it is that we hold ourselves in our thinking, because that is that's the central predominant reason why we speak what we and how we speak. So to get a sense of how it is that we hold ourselves in our thoughts, you know, if some of you might have read Sharon's book, Loving Kindness, and you know, after years and years and years and years and years of metta practice and insight practice, she was doing something in the house and she did something stupid, and instead of saying, you stupid thing, which most of us would have had an inward verbal reprimand, she started to do that and then said, but you're beautiful. But you're a lovely person. And that came out of her just spontaneously through the door in the rift of abuse came the metta. But that's knowing oneself very, very well. Mostly those things slip through many times in an hour. Not sitting up, sit up. What's the matter with you? It's nice. It's just amazing what we do to ourselves. So to have a sense of inward integrity. We're not going to do that. I'm not going to think that way anymore about myself. Just let those thoughts go. I've gone down that way. 10,000 times I've run my head into that wall. Not going to go down there. You don't have to go all journey it every single time. We can just, not going to go. That's wise avoidance. It's also known as wisdom. And then we just sit mindfully, grounded in the body. In stillness, huh? So feel it. Now, this is not your stillness. The problem is that many times during the day, we fall into these still patterns, like these patterns in which the story doesn't continue, in which there is thoughtless awareness.